Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich, and I'm here for this interview episode, joined by two of my colleagues. I have Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
And returning to join us again, Johanna Desta.
Hello.
You guys are the lucky conductors of this week's two interviews. First, we'll hear Johanna talking to Maud Apatow about her role in Euphoria, and then Rebecca will talk to Andrew Garfield about Under the Banner of Heaven. So let's start, Johanna, with you and Maud. You have been my kind of Euphoria guide, as someone who is has, I think, the stomach to watch this show, which I still feel very anxious about. And when I was talking to you about who really had a standout role on this season, I think Maud was a really obvious one for you. What made this such a good season for her?
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of a slow burn for her character, but she really owns the finale. The spoiler alert, the show ends on a play that she has secretly been writing the entire time. And it's this weird kind of meta play about her sister and all her friends, and it kind of torches the school down. So it's high, high drama. And she's really, really great as a maniacal theater kid.
Is that something that we saw the potential for her in previous seasons, or was this really her coming out as a powerful character and an actress?
Yeah, you know, last season she was really on the back burner. And something that Maud told me is that when she signed on for the show, Sam told her, look, Sam Levinson, the creator, he told her that season one is just going to be kind of slow going, but season two is really where her character is going to shine. So she's kind of been lying in wait.
Oh, that's interesting. That takes such patience, I think, as a young actor wanting to prove yourself, to go through it a whole season knowing you have to wait.
Yeah. But, you know, something that I didn't know before is that she had also starred in his film Assassination Nation. So she had worked with him before. So she kind of had that implicit trust in him that he was going to keep his word and really let her character shine in the second season.
Yeah. What else did you guys talk about in the interview?
Oh, we talked about all kinds of things. She had just gone to the Met Gala, so we talked about that. We also talked about, I was so interested in the meta quality of her character this season and the fact that her father, Judd, has also written things about his life, and she's played meta versions of herself and his work. And she talked a little bit about being inspired by that and how she's also writing something about her own life that she hopes to make someday. Yeah, which I think is really interesting.
Well, I'm excited to hear your interview with Maud Apatow. But first, let's hear a word from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hello.
Hi.
But yeah, I guess one quick question that I had, how are you? How was the Met Gala? You've been very busy and very glamorous. How are things?
Oh my gosh, the Met Gala was so scary, but so fun. It's so many weeks of buildup and anxiety about your outfit and your look. And then it sort of happened really quickly and it was very fun. Once I got there, I could relax and have a good time. But yeah, it's scary. It's so scary.
It's like a lot of stairs. It seems like a very intimidating atmosphere and space, but you looked so great. I loved the look that you were wearing.
Thanks.
Well, obviously I have so many questions about Euphoria, which was so huge in its second season. And you are incredible in it. I mean, the first season did really, really well. It was an enormous success. And then the second season just has built upon that. And for viewers who watch, they know that Lexi's second season, it's kind of where your storyline and your arc really jumps out. I was curious, could you talk to me a little bit about when Sam let you know that season two was really going to be, you know, Lexi's time to shine?
So I met Sam. We made a movie together called Assassination Nation when I was a freshman in college. I first met him on Zoom in my dorm room, and we really hit it off. And I thought the meeting went terribly, but I guess it went well. So I flew to audition for him in person, and we did that movie together. And I think Sam is so smart, and he's always been so supportive of me. It really means a lot. Like, I was so nervous in this meeting and the audition too, but he really pushed me out of my comfort zone. That Assassination Nation audition lasted like 35 minutes, which is insanely long for an audition. He just let me go and improv it until we got it right. And yeah, he's just always, I don't know, he's always been very supportive of me. And I feel like he knows what I'm capable of. And so it sort of pushes me more than anyone I've worked with before. So then we did that movie together. And I heard he was working on Euphoria, but I didn't really know any details about it. And then I auditioned, whatever, I got the part, and he told me straight up right away, like, season one is not where your arc is, it's gonna be season two. So I knew that going into it.
I love that he was just upfront with you, and he had that plan for your character all along, which has got to be kind of exciting. Like, that's a guarantee that you're definitely going to be in season two.
Yeah, it was nice.
Yeah.
Unless I really screwed up season one.
So. He's like, scratch that. I don't know about Lexi anymore. Yeah. But just, like, diving back into the Lexi of it all, the season two of it all, her arc is really tremendous, and it kind of starts with, you know, this her and Fezco, will they, won't they? And it's really surprising, but really heartwarming. And I've read that it was something that you suggested to Sam because you and Angus are just friends in real life. Tell me all about, you know, suggesting that to him and how that storyline came into play.
Yeah, I mean, I just called Sam one day and we ended up talking on the phone for like 3 hours about different things that could happen in the season two arc. But we kind of like played around and named a bunch of different characters. And then when we started talking about Angus, it was clear that was that was the one. And then we were just cracking up talking about how different conversations they could have. And I don't know. We just thought the idea was so funny.
It's so good. It's
one and of those sweet things, kind of.
Extremely sweet. It's just one of those things, like when it started happening in the episode, I was watching it like, huh? And then I was immediately into it, like two thumbs up. Yes, I'm so glad these two are talking, and I'm so glad that it was carried over the course of the season. But so you and Angus are friends in real life. Talk to me a bit about how, like, your friendship began and how it inspired that storyline.
I mean, we're all very close friends in the cast. I think we got so lucky that we're all the same age and going through a very similar experience together. And we're so lucky that we all love and support each other as much as we do, because it all can be very overwhelming sometimes. And so we just all got really close. I mean, we have a lot of time, you know, downtime in our trailers, and we'll all sit around and talk. And so that's kind of how Angus and I became friends, because we didn't have a lot of scenes together last season, but we, or season one, but we always were just hanging out outside. Like when we were shooting the carnival scenes, I remember we just pulled a bunch of all-nighters on set, and we're just sitting together and cracking up and like going on the rides. And so we just became friends really quickly, all of us.
I mean, you said the word overwhelming, which I kind of want to circle back to, because I imagine in so many senses, it's like the material of the show is a lot. You know, the fact that it's so huge is a lot. Like the work that you have to do as an actor is a lot. Talk to me a bit about, you know, what is overwhelming about the world of Euphoria?
Yeah, I mean, season one, we didn't really know if anyone was going to watch the show. We just kind of hoped it was going to turn out well. And we didn't get to see much of it as we were shooting. So none of us had any idea what to expect. And then obviously when the show came out and so many people watched it, I guess like, yeah, there is some pressure coming back for a second season, and you know, people have high expectations of what it should be, and it's a lot of pressure sometimes. But I mean, the shots are so beautiful, but they're so beautiful because we have these cranes and crazy dolly tracks, like hundreds of feet of dolly tracks, and the shots are very complicated and take a while to set up. And so we end up shooting for 8.5 months, which is a pretty long shoot for 8 episodes.
Wow,
so
yeah.
I think the amount of time, sometimes you're, I don't know, when you're doing anything for that long, you're sort of, you're in the thick of it, and mm-hmm. it feels like that's the only thing in the world, and you want to do a good job so badly. And so, but overwhelming, like it's never a super negative overwhelm. It's always mm-hmm. positive. Like we're just running around and it just feels like fast paced and we got to go. And, but it's 8 months of that. So after a while we're like, oh shoot, we're tired, but we're going to keep going.
Yeah. It's a lot. It's a lot. But I mean, the end result is really incredible. I mean, you're talking about some of these shots. It's like unbelievable looking.
Oh, always. And it's so, like sometimes, rarely I'll be sitting there like, does it really need to have this crane? Like, is this really necessary? And then I see it, I'm like, oh yeah, 100%. This is the most gorgeous thing I've ever seen in my mm-hmm. life. It's all worth it in the end.
Yeah. What's one of the more like technically difficult scenes that you've had to do where it was the most like, you gotta hit your mark because the crane's coming here and dolly here, like.
There were a lot. So during the play scenes, there were like a couple just oners backstage. So I'd run down the stairs and circle around, and you just had to hit every single mark or the scene was destroyed. So we ended up having to do it a bunch of times. But yeah, it's tricky. It's that one scene backstage. At the end, I put a wig on and say I love the theater. But I remember we did the scene like so many times, but we got it at the end and it was so worth it. So yeah, you know how it is.
I love that scene. I knew exactly what scene you were talking about. And I have so many questions about like the big theater finale that I want to circle back to, because it's just many, many, many questions. Before I ask about the theater of it all, like the two episodes over the end, I loved there's that meta moment in the third episode when we're kind of getting into Lexi's story a bit more. And she starts talking about herself as the observer. And we see Lexi observing everything as like the movie of her life. And all her friends are actors. Her parents are actors. And there's this really fun meta quality to it, because you're also an actor and you're on a set. And there's just so many layers to it. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that scene in particular and how you connected to it or related to it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, in that scene, when I walk off stage, a ton of the crew members are in it. So the first woman that I meet when I'm walking out is Sam's assistant, Marlise. And then our actual AD, Sally, was who I was Amazing. Talking to in all those scenes. And I sat next to our script supervisor, Gurky. So we all had a lot of fun that day because we all got to act in it. And it was really special. But yeah, I think that was a really important, I mean, it sort of introduces us to the whole play in the end. I'm glad they sort of explained it, because I always felt like that's how Lexi felt watching everyone else. Like, she always was watching and never really spoke up for herself. And so, I don't know, it's like sort of a quietness, but there is so much going on in her head. And I think that's sort of the first time that we see that, that she's not just sitting there quietly, like she's thinking about it all so much, but it sort of manifests mm-hmm. in this quiet way. Like, her exterior is so different than what's going on inside. But I thought the sequence turned out really cool. That's another one of those big wonders that I was talking about.
Yeah, totally. It's very complicated to watch and think about, like, how it's just going the entire time. Well, now I want to ask about Lexi's play, which is really, really extraordinary. And I've read, and you've talked about the fact that it was inspired by you in high school. For those who don't know, can you talk a little bit about, like, the play that inspired this scene?
Yes. So in high school, I mean, I did theater all through high school and middle school and my whole life. And so when I was a senior in high school, we had a production that we, as a senior class, wrote and directed and produced. And I was the producer, so I was kind of in charge with two other girls. And for some reason, I think it was just a mix of how scared I was about graduating and leaving home and saying goodbye to all my friends, that I channeled all of that energy into making the show perfect. But it was just crazy. Like, I don't know what happened, but I took it so seriously, and I think mm-hmm. it was for the best, because apparently it was the best show in years and still is. But I
of course,
no, I definitely channeled all of that weird energy into the show and became sort of this tyrant. Yeah. And I talked to Sam about that when we were kicking around the ideas for the play, and that sort of makes sense, because I think Lexi and I are very similar in that way. I think I'm pretty shy too, but I really care. And so when I'm stressed, I think that sometimes manifests in strange ways, but it's the same thing as Lexi. Like, she just wants everything to work out perfectly. Mm-hmm. And everything in her life is falling apart around her, like, to way more of an extreme than mine was. Like, you, like, Rue and her sister, and it's just, what do you do with all of that? And she just mm-hmm. puts it into the show, and it manifests as this sort of aggression, but also I think right. it's like a healthy way of processing all of that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it turns out to be like a weirdly cathartic night for a lot of people in the show.
Yeah.
What was your favorite part about the play that Lexi puts on?
So Austin Abrams, who plays Ethan in the show, and I worked a lot together, and he's an amazing actor. And he did all of the, like, he played Suze and the photographer, mm-hmm. and each part that he played, he put 100% into it and was so funny. And it was so amazing getting to work with him. I really think he's so, so talented. And we just had a lot of fun, because both of us grew up doing theater and hadn't done it in years. And so we were blocking all these scenes like we were doing a play, and then we'd get on stage and perform to a real audience of like 250 people. So we were just having the best time ever and cracking up. And like, I'm trying to think of my favorite part. I mean, the dance number, obviously, I'm not in that part,
it's so
but
good.
Watch,
yeah.
That's Austin. He's just such a badass, and he worked so hard, and it all paid off and looked amazing. He's just great. So we had a lot of fun together, and obviously all of the girls.
Mm-hmm.
But we had the best time. It was just a blast.
Yeah, he's so great. That dance number is unbelievable. But I will say, what really makes it sing is all the reaction shots of Lexi, like, watching it so intensely, like, mouthing along just to the beats and like the lyrics and stuff. I loved all those parts, but that is totally the centerpiece
of the show.
We shot
like a reaction for 30 minutes. So they did the dance, and I had to just react, and I knew the camera was on me. That was a rough one.
30
minutes.
Made
me,
the gesture that you are doing cannot be shown, but for anyone who's seen it, it's the gesture that Lexi does.
And should not be described.
Right. Wow, yeah, 30 minutes, that's a long time. but kudos to you for acting through it. Well, something I'm curious about as well, obviously the show is shot on film. Like, does that add a different layer of pressure? Does it feel the same? Talk to me a bit about that.
I kind of thought maybe beforehand that it would, but it didn't at all. I think it felt very similar, except for the fact that we didn't know what it was going to look like. But we could see on the monitor sort of an idea of it. And yeah, you only have, I think it's 10 or 12 minutes per role, but it sort of makes you want to focus a little bit more and get it done. And yeah, I think if anything, it was kind of more helpful. Just lit a fire under your ass a little bit.
Right, because you know that clock is ticking. So, so you're acting for 30 minutes, but with a role change. Maybe two role changes.
Yeah.
Well, I tip my hat to you. Well, something that I was curious about as you were talking about your past theater life and playing Lexi in the theater, are you interested in theater in the future? Are you interested in Broadway and going back into that world?
Yeah, I would love to do that more than anything. I mean, the first play that I did, and I think I was in second grade. I don't know if it was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I don't know which order it was, but I just knew that was what I was meant to do always. People ask me, because of your family, did you feel pressure to be in this industry? And I just knew immediately, like, that's where I felt the most happy and free. And I don't know, I love doing theater more than anything. So hopefully one day I get to do that again.
If you could select anything, I mean, barring, I don't know if you're superstitious, but putting it out to the universe, like what are some of your favorite plays or what's something that you would like love to be in?
My senior year of high school, I was in Cabaret, and I was Sally Bowles in Cabaret, and it was the best. I just had the best time doing that. And I got to see Emma Stone do it in New York before I did it. And I really look up to her. I think she's so amazing. And I think her career has been so perfect. And so I really look up to her, and I saw her and she blew my mind. She was so, so great. And it was so powerful. And since then, I was like, I want to do that. And then I did get to do it in high school. So maybe one day I'll get to do it again.
Oh, I love that. Fingers crossed. Well, you mentioned your family very briefly. Who would you say is the biggest Euphoria fan in the Apatow family?
I think my dad. My dad loves it, which is kind of weird. I didn't expect him to like it as much as he does, but he really was moved by it. And my sister obviously loves it, and her friends love it, which is really, really
of
cute.
Course. Yeah. Well, that's gotta be cool to be, because she's your younger sister. So if you're doing something cool, it's like nice for the younger siblings to enjoy it and like validate it.
I know, I feel cool because her friends are intimidating. My sister is, she's younger than me, but she's definitely cooler than me. So all of her friends come around. They're like, hey, Maude, want to tell us any secrets? I'm like, no, I can't.
Gotta zip my lips, but thank you for watching. I love that. Well, that's really fun. I guess Lexi is also, for a parent, that's like a character that you can watch, whereas some of the other characters are really gone through some things, so it might be harder for a parent to watch. But yeah, I love that your dad is the biggest fan of it.
He definitely is. I always think, though, I should have said this earlier, but Lexi comes off like the nice one, but I think she actually is similar to the rest of the girls. Like, you see this anger, and I don't know, she's definitely got issues too, and I feel like we got to see that this season. That she seems like the sweet one, but I'm like, is she even that sweet?
What she did was, I love the hushed tone for, what she does with the play is, it's a pretty vicious move. So yeah, that's true. You're just like nodding. Yeah,
I'm nodding. Uh-huh. I'm like, oh, I forgot we're on the podcast format.
But people feel it. They can feel the nod.
Of course.
That's actually, on the flip side of that, something I am curious about that I just thought of is, you know, she's writing something that's very meta and autobiographical. And then you mentioned your family, like your father has done stuff that's autobiographical and you've acted in it. So you've experienced playing characters that have this meta layer to them. Are you ever interested in writing something autobiographical or doing something meta, some other project?
Of course, yeah. I mean, I'm a writer too, and I think there's definitely a line. So Lexi didn't realize that maybe you don't make it that obvious, but obviously it's so hard not to write from your life and about people you know and experiences you've had. So hopefully one day I'll be able to do that in a way that doesn't hurt people too much.
I think you've earned the right to write something autobiographical. But I'm dying to see it, whatever it is. Would it be like a film? Would it be a series? Do you know yet? Is it too soon to say?
I think it's too soon to say. But I've got something in the works.
Oh my gosh. Okay, well, I'm dying to know more. Please tell me first.
Okay.
Before, you know, your friends and the other people in your life, because I am dying to know. But that's very exciting. That's cool.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, actually, I did want to ask, because I love the heart-to-heart scene between you and Zendaya in the final episode. Talk to me a bit about prepping that and doing that scene with her, because it's really, really special what the both of you do.
Yeah, that last scene with Zendaya, I mean, we didn't get the last script. It was sort of like, that was a very top secret script, I think, because at that point they didn't know who was going to die, what we were talking about earlier, and I don't know, it was very secretive. And so I got that scene pretty close to when we shot it, but I definitely realized that, I don't know, from season one, like the entire arc made sense. That scene, it's this friendship that's falling apart, coming back together. And it was so well written by Sam. I remember doing it the first time with Zendaya, and it just like instantly felt like we both understood it so much. And, you know, we've been shooting for years and we've had all these really tough scenes together. And it was so nice to have this heart to heart and have this sweet scene together. And at this point too, like Zendaya and I know are really close, and we just, because it was so well written, it just sort of happened really well. It was like the dream scene. I don't know. I think Sam did such a good job and we just got it right away, but it felt really good.
All comes through. Yeah,
no, it's just, I mean, I feel like it's a dream for an actor to have a scene that's written that way, and obviously a partner like Zendaya, who's such an amazing actress, it just sort of, it was really special. That was my favorite scene to shoot the whole season.
Okay, so now, Rebecca, we're going to hear your conversation with Andrew Garfield. He has been so incredibly busy. We were talking about him all through Oscar season for his role in Tick, Tick, Boom, and now he's right back at it on Under the Banner of Heaven. And as soon as you were done doing this interview, you basically said to me, like, oh my God, I love Andrew Garfield so much.
I really feel like I've gotten to spend a lot of quality time with Andrew Garfield because he's been in award season for like an entire year now. But it was interesting to, you know, do this interview. We did it over Zoom because he's actually not working right now. He's like hiding out in Malibu, and he seems so much calmer that I sort of started the interview being like, are you okay? He's like, I'm just relaxed. You haven't seen me relaxed. So it's kind of nice to see him, you know, finally getting a break after this like crazy year and a half he's had.
I'm genuinely happy for him. Like, not that I, you know, feeling sorry for movie stars is a funny thing, but like, he must be exhausted.
Yeah, I think he is. But he really seemed to love this role and this project. So he was excited to talk about it, even though he seemed totally burned out.
Yeah, we've talked about Under the Banner of Heaven on this show before, and how really intense it is, and his role as this Mormon detective investigating this really horrifying murder and the personal revelations it brings about for him. So I assume you guys got into some detail about that in the interview.
Yeah, I mean, he talked a lot about how he felt a responsibility to learn as much as he could about the Mormon community and sort of understanding why someone, particularly a white man, would be which he pointed out, I did not, but would be attracted to this community and this and sort of the support you get within it. So I think he felt a lot of responsibility to represent the community, right? And especially talk to ex-Mormons about, you know, how they sort of lost their faith in it, because that's sort of what the detective goes through as he investigates his case.
And that's a group of people that includes the show's writer, Dustin Lance Black, which I assume is a major resource for him.
Yeah, it sounds like Dustin Lance Black connected him to a lot of his, you know, friends who had sort of gone through similar experiences.
Well, let's listen to your conversation with Under the Banner of Heaven's Andrew Garfield.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. What kind of answer would you like? Would you like a...
No, you seem a little... Are you tired? What's going on?
Oh, wow. Thanks a lot. I'm very, very relaxed.
Oh, that's good.
And maybe you're just not used to seeing a relaxed person. No, I'm just very relaxed. I think we last saw each other in the middle of all the press-y, campaign-y stuff, which just takes on a different... I don't know. The energy is just very different. And then here... Yeah, I don't know. It's nice. I've just been up in life, so you're just kind of catching me midlife.
Well, I hope you're enjoying life. But I did want to talk about Under the Banner of Heaven because I think your performance is so wonderful in the show. I just found so engrossing. So maybe we can start with, how did this project first come into your orbit, and what was sort of your first impression of it?
So yeah, so I read Krakauer's book when it first came out, and I found it just very, very interesting how he so elegantly and fascinatingly connected the founding of a kind of newish religion of Mormonism, the inception of this new religion, with this terribly gruesome, ego-driven murder that occurred in the Mormon community in the 80s. The writing is just kind of so marvelous, and his way of connecting these unseen threads, these previously unseen threads, was just astounding to me. And so, of course, like everyone else who makes movies and theater and TV, I thought, well, who's going to get the rights and who's going to try to adapt this impossible book? And I was excited to see that Imagine had the rights, and that Dustin Lance Black was looking to do it, him being an ex-Mormon himself and having such a personal connection to the material. And then I just didn't think about it for a while until Lance called me and said, I think I've cracked it, this book, and I would love you to... I've created a fictional character that has been the kind of the breakthrough for me in terms of making the story thrilling and narratively, I don't know, exciting and also emotional, to give a kind of emotional focal point, a kind of solid center in the middle of this very multi-dimensional, multi-narrative story. And I would love you to have a read. And I just found, you know, his writing so riveting and so honoring of Krakauer's book, but also honoring of his own personal experiences in this faith. And I don't know, he made a great TV show out of it. And I thought, well, like, oh gosh, this is a heavy duty material and a heavy duty subject, and we'll be in Calgary for 6 months. But I couldn't say no. It was one of those annoying projects where I kind of said, well, this is a subject matter that interests me so much, and I think it has so much potential healing and enlightenment for an audience in terms of religion, in terms of spirituality, in terms of, or lack thereof, with, you know, spiritual, you know, a kind of our worst impulses masquerading as somehow being godly. And, you know, it's a show and story about being susceptible to extremism and fundamentalism. And obviously we're in a moment right now where we're all incredibly susceptible to our own echo chambers and to a kind of a narrow view, a kind of shallow view of the world and of ourselves and of what life is about, a kind of weirdly materialistic view of the world. And I think in times of such uncertainty and collapse, it is tempting for us to kind of fall prey to simple answers, which is obviously a big part of what this show's about. And it all just was ringing the right bells for the time we're in and what I wanted to express as an actor and the people I wanted to work with. It was just a very, very, it was a no-brainer, as it were.
And so your character, who's the detective that's sort of investigating this case, which is a real case, but your character is obviously fictionalized, as you mentioned. How much did you feel like you needed to learn about Mormon religion and this community? And did you find anything that really surprised you as you're preparing?
Yeah, I mean, I had to, I had to feel like I was Mormon. That was what the main part of the job was, because then once we were filming, the main journey that my character Jeb Pyrie goes on is that his foundations get slowly taken apart, and his foundations are based in his church, are based in the container that he was born into and brought up in, which is the Mormon church. So of course my responsibility to playing the part was to simulate that for myself, create a cellular body relationship to a set of beliefs and rules and ideas that I was so fully invested in, and find where that is in my life, find where that is in my imagination, and so that I could show up on a day-to-day basis and allow my foundations to get rocked and cracked in a way that was subtle and internal and truthful. So I got to study what it was to be a Mormon, and I got to try to fall in love with that religion. And there was a lot to fall in love with, like with any organized religion. There's such beauty. And in Mormonism, what I found quite beautiful was, and I think you probably would find this in most religions, is a true sense of community. You know, a kind of an access to a wider family that feels inclusive to white people, and supportive to white people and men particularly, and all of the things that I am, and empowering to white men, and so I think if I could, I had to figure out a way of, but Jeb is a modern Mormon in this. And this is another thing that I found really kind of beautiful and interesting. And a lot of the Mormons that I met while I was doing my research around the subject, I visited Salt Lake City in Utah, and I, you know, spoke to a lot of Dustin Lance Black's friends and lots of incredible people, ex-Mormons, police officer Mormons, cop Mormons who used to be Mormons, who had a crisis of faith. You know, I got a whole kind of array of experiences from this community. And I think where Jeb lives is in a very modern state, and he has an equal in his wife. And that was thankfully like a part of the character that I think it would probably be much harder for Sam Worthington and Wyatt Russell and the rest of the Lafferty brothers, the actors who play the Lafferties, to get into a kind of misogynistic, female subjugating mindset, because they're all just decent guys. So, but for me, I got to play a more modern version of what it is to be a Mormon, and someone who's obviously sensitive enough to have an openness to his faith and his belief system being questioned. I think that is a rare quality for someone who's so rooted and enmeshed with their faith, to be curious enough, I suppose, imaginative enough, and honest enough to be able to face questioning something that is so brutalizing to their own lives, that is going to be so violent in terms of the upheaval it's going to do to his own life. That is a quality that I admire in anyone, someone who's willing to have their minds changed and have their hearts changed if it means an illusion is lifted and you start to see more reality. And that's the journey that Jeb Pyrie goes on. And I find it, and having spoken to a bunch of people who have been through that very experience, those were the people that I felt like I had to represent, the ex-Mormons or any ex anything, you know, people who were raised in a certain way, who realized that this way was fundamentally dangerous. So I met a lot of people who had been through this experience, and it enhanced my sense of responsibility and the kind of, it put the flesh on the bone, I suppose, for Jeb and for my passion in wanting to honor Jeb and all the people that Jeb represents.
As you say, this character really goes on this journey, and I'm curious if it was challenging to shoot that in a television show. I know most shows sort of shoot out of order and, you know, you have to go back and forth in his emotional state. What was that like for you?
Yeah, it's tricky because it's subtle, you know, it's not, he doesn't have the big speech and the big whatever, you know, there's not, he's a very ordinary dude, you know, and I think that was one of the things that was appealing to me about playing the character, is that how do I express a lot with not a lot, you know, that felt very interesting to me, having of course just come from playing a very expressive musical theater writer who is all pure expression all the time, wearing his heart on his sleeve constantly. I felt excited to be challenged by a kind of more internal process and trusting that things would be expressed if I thought and felt them without having to show them and without having to, you know, Jonathan Larson kind of, thrust it down everyone's throats all the time. So it was really interesting to jump back and forth because it's so incremental, you know, and that's obviously the beauty of long form storytelling, which I haven't ever done. I've never done a miniseries in this way and been able to plot and kind of deliver an experiential journey, a slow burn for a character in that way over the course of 7-hour-long episodes. It was incredibly privileged that I got to do that. But yeah, it was tricky because it's mostly just little pieces of dust crumbling from his foundations every moment.
How much time did you have after Tick, Tick, Boom before this started up?
I finished Tick, Tick, Boom end of 2020, I want to say. Where are we, 2022? Yeah, mm-hmm. End of 2020. And then I went in the beginning of 2021 and visited a friend in Atlanta and had to make a movie there that I'm now allowed to talk about, but I'm still kind of like weirdly like PTSD about like not talking about a thing that people know I'm now in. So I went and did the Spider-Man.
Is visiting a friend just the code word you use for shooting Spider-Man for like 2 years?
That was what Lin-Manuel Miranda would always reference when he would be like, so what are you doing after this, buddy? I'm like, oh, I've got to go and visit a friend in Atlanta. And he was like, uh-huh. And I was like, no, I'm literally visiting a friend. And I was visiting a friend, but that wasn't the primary reason.
Oh, that friend wasn't Tobey Maguire.
No, but but he's a friend that was also happened to be there.
So now that the show's been out, do you pay attention to reactions and reviews when something like this comes out and really becomes a point of conversation?
I have a, you know, like every creative person that has to deal with that, I have a very complex relationship with it. And I always have, and I probably always will. I hope I don't, but I think my intention always is to, first and foremost, keep my own counsel with how I feel a thing has turned out, a project. And when I say keep my own counsel, I also mean me and a few of my closest kind of creative people. And I try and make that the primary kind of relationship. But then, of course, it's hard not to look. And also with this, I was very curious because it's such a big show. And Dustin Lance Black had created something so sprawling and ambitious and multi-narrative. And I was incredibly curious and excited to see the other parts of the story that I wasn't involved in, like the Brenda Lafferty strand and the Joseph Smith Brigham Young strand. And I was just excited. So, and then in terms of people's response to it, because obviously, you know, I love the book, and a lot of people have a relationship with that book. And then there, of course, there's the Mormon community, and then there's the ex-Mormon community, and then there's just a general true crime watching TV public. So is that, you know, there's going to be a lot of, we're going to have a smorgasbord of responses, and everyone's coming from their own realities. So to me, if I can be objective and distance anything, like take my own personal need for people to like my work out of the equation, then it just becomes interesting to see how people respond to the same piece of art, the same story, and how their own experiences shape that response. So yeah, I have, and the short answer is, yeah, I've been curious, so I looked.
But you're not on social media. You're just a...
Not officially. I'm a creep. I creep around. I kind of just skulk in the background, just watching other people engage in this dangerous wild west of virtual zero consequence reality. I find that interesting too. But yeah, I'm not strong enough to engage.
You're much better off, I would say, than those.
Yeah, I know, and I know that's a privileged position as well. You know, I think a lot of people rely on it for work and for life, and I fully respect that. I can't. Yeah, I'm lucky that I don't right now. Never say never. Need to participate.
So you were in Oscar season, as I was, you know, and that is quite a circus in a long few months with your films. And now, you know, you've had the show come out, and now we're in the conversations of Emmy season. And I'm not a lot of people have to do those back to back. So I'm curious for you, what's sort of your perspective on that long journey that you have to participate in if your show or film is a part of that conversation?
You know, it's a very, very lovely thing to make things that people like. And it's something that I just feel incredibly lucky that when I'm invited to those parties, that I'm, and if I'm proud of the work, and if I feel like it, the work represents me and my longings here to that I want to express while I'm alive, like Tick, Tick, Boom does, like Under the Banner of Heaven does, and, you know, even like my small participation in the Spider-Man film does. I look at those pieces of work and I go, yeah, this is a lot of a sincere expression of what I want to express. And it's never going to be complete, and it's never going to be perfect. It's never going to be the kind of flawless thing that I want it to be. But to have that be received in the way that you're talking about is quite humbling, really. And I don't take it for granted, and I appreciate it deeply, because I don't know, it's encouraging. It's encouragement, and it's acceptance from our community. It's acceptance from our peers. It's also a responsibility, I think. I think about this a lot, and I've been thinking about it since, because I've had some time off, and it's been great to just be able to, you know, reflect on this very question in this whole period of time is, well, what are you going to do with it? You know, what are you going to do with the attention that you're given? And that's a very liberating question for me, because I want to make it about something bigger. I always want to take that, whatever that attention and whatever that energy is, and Aikido it towards something that is bigger than myself, and something that is about what we're all doing here, like illuminating what we're all doing here on this floating rock in the cosmos. I think that if we can keep our attention trained on that kind of meta perspective, then I think we will be in better shape and in good shape. And I think as storytellers and as artists, that's what our job is to throw up a frame and direct attention, or give opportunity for our attention to be directed towards spiritual matters, matters of life and death, matters of meaning and meaninglessness, matters of love and relationship and existential questions. So that for me is my ultimate desire. And I think being a part of these conversations in terms of the question you're asking only helps bring more attention to stuff which may be more important.
And you mentioned having some time off, and I know there was a story about how you plan to just take a little time after being so busy for the last couple of years. And I'm curious, how does that time let you sort of decide what's next? Do you have an idea about where you go from here?
I think that's the beauty of it is, and what we forget, I think, maybe what I forget, I'll speak for myself, is, I don't know, I think we're all somewhat addicted to work, and there's a kind of not never enoughness that we feel, a kind of, I don't know, this post-industrialist psyche of, well, you're only as value as however many units you produce. This kind of modern times notion that I think is a real missing of the mark in terms of our collective psyche. I have nothing wrong with working hard. Like, I love working hard, but I think in order to do it in a way that is soulful and effective, we have to be coming from a full cup. I speak to my brother speak about this all the time because we have the same disease in the sense that we both are just so identified with our work, and he's a doctor, and he's the kind of doctor you want looking after you because he will stay for 3 hours longer than he's supposed to. But then we both talk about this, and we're like, well, how do we come from an authentic place? How do we come from a place of abundance rather than a place of scarcity so that we can be actually incredibly effective at what we do, and it's not just a kind of series of burnouts, because that's no way to live a life. I think there's a whole other kind of more receptive aspect of living that I need to be able to do in order to come back and create, you know. And so right now I think it's a real a challenging allowing of one's myself to not know. And that feels like a very vulnerable place to be, because I think we're taught that we always have to have some kind of knowing about where we're supposed to be walking and how we're supposed to be living. But then once I think you fall into the not knowing and you allow yourself to be in the not knowing, that's when deeper images come. That's when deeper ideas come and something more sincere might emerge. I've been reading Thoreau and Walden Pond, you know, just kind of like his year just sitting in that one and walking that one patch of land, you know. And I've been reading John O'Donohue and some David White and, you know, these kind of nature philosophers, kind of spiritualists. And it's been kind of enhancing my rest time and kind of reminding me that there's nowhere to be, like that we all belong. We all belong here, whether or not we're making good TV. You know what I mean? Like, we're all worthy of the air we breathe. We all belong on this planet. We all belong to each other and belong to ourselves. And we don't have to be constantly proving our worth. And I think maybe in our 20s, that is a kind of an energy and a kind of archetypal, you know, initiatory phase of we have to plant off. We feel a need to plant our flag and to let the world know that we are here and this is what we're about. And to like say our name loud and say this is who we are. And maybe, I don't know, maybe as the metabolism slows down and, you know, I definitely feel it in my 30s where I'm like, oh no, I, and also, you know, with the experience, when you start to experience more loss and realizing that this is all finite, I think it can do one of two things. It can either create a kind of stress-induced panic and rush a la Jonathan Larson, or it can make everything, it can make you slow down and create more presence. And I oscillate between those two things. Like, I can get into both of those kind of states of being where I'm like, I've got to get it all done quicker and quicker and more and bigger, and it's never enough. And but then if I, yeah, this period of time has been a really wonderful kind of slowing down and a kind of a reconnection with the ordinary and the kind of simple rhythm of just being here.
That does it for today's interview episode. We'll be back on Thursday with a regular roundtable conversation. In the meantime, find us at vanityfair.com, where you can find more coverage of Euphoria and Under the Banner of Heaven. You can follow us on Twitter at Little Gold Men, and on our own, I am at Katie Rich. Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
And Johanna.
At Johanna Desta.
Also, please sign up to text with us at joinsubtext.com/littlegoldmen or text 213-513-7180. Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.